This is Torah Jazz, session number 2, Parshas Matos Maaseh. And we're coming to you live on location in beautiful Carmiel in the Matan Nachliel Shul. It's 11:35 at night. As for now, I have the base measure to myself. Hopefully nobody will complain. And if they do, okay, we'll figure it out. Okay, great. So, in this week's Parsha, well, I guess that depends where you are. So let's just say what Parsha we're talking about. In Parsha's Matos, we have one of the most baffling and simultaneously dramatic moments of all of the Chumash in the approach of the B'nai Reuven and B'nai Gad to Moshe Rabbeinu in the request to stay in Eiver HaYarden. We also have the mysterious appearance of a B'nai Menashe, half the tribe of Menashe, no, not the fellows from India, the original tribe of Menashe, or half of them, who seem to fall into this whole story seemingly out of nowhere. Where do they come from, and what's their purpose in this whole story? Okay, we're also hopefully going to answer a question that has puzzled Western philosophers for about a decade now. There was one group of wise men who said, cash rules everything around me. Cream. Get the money. Dollar bills, y'all. To which a wise man retorted to them, it's all about the Benjamin's baby. What were they arguing about? Were they arguing? Is one of them right? Is one of them more in alignment with the way that the Torah views the world? Hopefully we'll get to that, but it's going to be a circuitous route. So, here we go. Pele Plaim, how could the B'nai Reuven and B'nai Gad come to Moshe Rabbeinu? Where do they have the temerity from to say that they wish to stay outside of Eretz Yisrael? I mean, wasn't that the whole point of leaving Mitzrayim in the first place? Right? I mean, if you look at the, it's interesting, Raya in Parshas Maaseh, in trying to understand why the Torah insists on listing all the different journeys of the Jewish people, Rashi brings the second understanding, the Tanhuma, which says, allegory of a father, a king taking his son off to a distant land to be healed. Now, what is that distant land? Eretz Yisrael, right? So we see that the whole leaving Mitzrayim, going into the desert, receiving the Torah, these are all steps in the journey to come to Eretz Yisrael, because the point isn't just to be a nation and to be a Kodesh Baruch Hu's nation with the Torah, it's to be a Kodesh Baruch Hu's nation with the Torah in Eretz Yisrael. So how could the B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven stop short and say no thank you? And more than that, when Moshe Rabbeinu responds to their request, we see that the tochacha that he gives them is for the fact that the result of their not entering the land will cause tremendous psychological damage to the Jewish people. It will dishearten them. They will lose resolve and possibly not want to enter the land of Israel, and we'll go back to the same situation we had once upon a time with the spies. And that we can't have. However, missing from Moshe Rabbeinu's rebuke is the very fact that they don't want to come into Eretz Yisrael. As long as they fulfilled Moshe Rabbeinu's conditions, which they do, which is to go into the war, and as a matter of fact, they volunteered to be at the front lines, in the front of the battle, and not to go back until every single Jewish person has settled inside their home with a white picket fence and a beautiful garden, 1.5 kids and a puppy, or 6.5 kids and a puppy, they will not go back to settle Eiver HaYarden. However, the whole notion that they're going to settle Eiver HaYarden is never discussed. This seems to not be a problem. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't seem to need to discuss it with anybody or confer with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. He seems to feel very confident that this is totally an okay thing to do. And that, again, is baffling. How could it be? Meaning, not only is this the request, but doesn't seem to be a problematic request whatsoever. The one rebuke Moshe Rabbeinu does give them, interestingly enough, as for the fact that he does seem to criticize them for having their priorities a bit mixed up. Why? When the B'nai Reuven and B'nai Gad give Moshe Rabbeinu their conditions that they will be willing to fight. They say that they're going to build pens for their sheep and cities for their children. Now, that would seem okay to most of us. Their priorities weren't totally messed up. They didn't say pens for their children and cities for their sheep. So that was pretty good. But no, if we would be on a higher level like Moshe Rabbeinu, we would understand that the fact that they put their sheep before their children already shows a weakness. They should have been putting their children before their sheep. And in the way that they presented their side to Moshe Rabbeinu, they should have said, we're going to build cities for our children and pens for our sheep. So there is a small rebuke over there, but it seems to be totally uncorrelated to, well, pretty much the whole story. So we have to see if this rebuke fits in at all. Now, there's three midrashim at the end of the Medrash Rabbah. All of them bear looking into. They're really wonderful and fascinating. I don't want to go through all of them completely because then you'll fall asleep. But, well, if you're falling asleep anyways, maybe I should. No, it's okay. You're going to have to look at them on your own. Here's the rough outline. The first Medrash, right? These are the last three Medrash of Medrash Rabbah. I think Zayin Chet and Tet. Yeah, Zayin Chet and Tet. The first Medrash says that there are three different gifts that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts into the world, right? And anybody who grasps any one of these, he merits everything, right? The word kol in itself is a deeper concept. But whatever kol is, anybody who merits any one of these things, chachma, right? Strength, gvura, chachma, wisdom, or smarts. Gvura, strength, osher, wealth. If a person merits to one of these things, he merits kol. He has a merit in kol. Now, the thing is, the condition that the Medrash brings is that it has to be given by Hashem and done for the sake of Torah. But if a person gets these things on his own, if these are done through Basar Vadam, they're worthless. The Medrash brings down three examples of two people, three which are two, which is six, each example being someone from the Bnei Yisrael and from the Ovdei Kochavim, from the Jews and the non-Jews, who had smarts, strength, wealth, and lost it. Now, on the Jewish side, these are names that we know, like Achitofel, Shimshon, Korach. This is the sort of company we're talking about. And at the end, the Medrash says, V'chein, and so too, the Bnei Reuven and the Bnei Gad. So this is whose company the Bnei Reuven and the Bnei Gad are being put in by the Medrash. Now, the Medrash already seems to be, right, we're starting a harsh critique of the action of the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven. So the Medrash says that they grabbed their wealth for themselves. And that's why, in the end, they were going to lose it. But more than that, the Medrash says, this is the reason they were punished, because they divided themselves off from the rest of the Jewish people for the sake of their money. And therefore, when the Jewish people were exiled, the Bnei Reuven, the Bnei Gad, were exiled first. Wow. So that's interesting, right? Because it seems like what they did was actually not so great, right? The Medrash is rebuking them. So why is this rebuke missing from Moshe Rabbeinu's discussion with the Bnei Reuven and Bnei Gad? But the bigger question is that this Medrash is followed by another Medrash, which is as follows. There was a certain Matrona. There was a certain fancy-schmancy rich lady. And now, I mean, you can tell that she was rich because seemingly she had nothing better to do than go around to all the Tanaim and ask them the same question. She asked Rav Shimon ben Chalafta how many days the world was created in. No, don't worry, she wasn't an evolutionist. Rav Shimon ben Chalafta answers and tells her that the world was created in 6 days. Right? As the verse says. And she says, well, if the world was created in 6 days, so what has HaKadosh Baruch Hu been doing for the last, you know, well, okay. Should I say it? How many years? 5,600? Should I say it? Okay. She didn't say how many years, but she just wanted to know what HaKadosh Baruch Hu had been doing for all those years. So, Rav Shimon ben Chalafta answers that he's been building, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has been building ladders. Kosh Baruch has been building ladders. The Kosh Baruch Hu is the Shofet, he's the judge. Who mashpil v'hu hu yorim, he's the one who casts down, he's the one that lifts up. The Kosh Baruch Hu basically is steering the lots and the fortunes of different people in this world, this one across from this one, bringing people up and down. So as a proof to this, we have the tribes of Reuven and Gad. That what? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to make them wealthy. So what did he do? He brought the Midianites to battle with them. They lost the battle, and their wealth went over to the B'nai Reuven and the B'nai Gad. And therefore, right, that's our example, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings people's fortunes from one to the other, brings others down while he lifts others up. That's how the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven became wealthy, as the verse says, that they had a tremendous amount of flocks. Now, this Medrash is so beautiful, and yet it's still a contradiction to the one we just read. Because the first Medrash we read said that the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven grabbed for themselves, that true wealth only succeeds when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives it to you. But here they grabbed it. However, the second Medrash says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought down the Midianites for what sake? For the sake of giving the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven their wealth. So which is it, Medrash? Did the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven grab it for themselves, or did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give it to them? Now the third Medrash, just because we're already here, let's just say it, was the Medrash that Rashi is quoting from. That in that Medrash it says, we're trying to understand the verse, Lev Chochom Limino V'Lev Ksil Lismolo. What does it mean that the heart of a wise man is to his right and the heart of the fool is to his left? In trying to understand the verse, what the verse is referring to, the Medrash brings three different examples. The first example is the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. The second example is Tzaddikim and Rishoyim, right? Righteous men and wicked men. The righteous men chase for Torah with their hearts, right? The Torah was given with a right. Mimino Eish Daslamo. The Rishoyim chase money, which is given with the left. B'smolo Osher V'Kavod. And the third example is Moshe Rabbeinu and the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven. Why? Because the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven put their property before their children. And Moshe Rabbeinu tells them to switch it the other way around. And therefore, the Medrash says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right, Chayechem, it makes a Shvuah, that they will not have bracha from this money. So, now again, thematically, the third Medrash seems a little bit similar to the first Medrash. Maybe we'll see if we can pry apart the differences a little bit. But also, we're going to have to figure out how this Medrash plays maybe into the whole decision and all the occurrences that fell out. Now, as far as the classic approach, I think, that a lot of people use, I mean, it's not such a old approach, it's a pretty recent approach, but a pretty popular one, is the approach of Rav Dessler. Now, Rav Dessler is troubled more than all the questions that we've asked by the fact that of all the people who are coming to Moshe Rabbeinu to ask this, we are speaking about the Dor Hadea. Now remember, this is not the generation that left Mitzrayim. The generation that left Mitzrayim had a lot of reservations about going into Eretz Yisrael. It was a tremendous change of reality to move from Mitzrayim and into the desert and to go to Eretz Yisrael, and each one of them was a totally different life approach, life outlook, connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, something that could be tremendously overwhelming. That generation is gone. They've died out. This is the Dor Hadea. This is the generation that was raised in the desert, fed mun from the time that they were little kids. That's a really interesting question. I never thought about that question. If a person was born in the desert and all he ever ate was mun, how would he know what food to think about in order that the mun should taste like that food? That's a funny question. Okay, I'm not going to answer that question. I don't think anybody else should think about it too deeply. But anyways, so this is the generation of the desert. It's a generation that grew up on Mun. This is a generation that their entire lives have been Amunas Hashem. There's no flaw that we know of in this generation. So what could possibly be going on with the B'nai Reuven and the B'nai Gad that they're holding themselves back from going into Eretz Yisrael? They cannot actually be scared to go in. What's going on? So Rav Dessler gives a very Kabbalistically approached answer that everybody has a different way of doing Avodas Hashem. There are different nitzotzos in this world that people are supposed to be Makadesh to bring them up. And for the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven, it was to be shepherds. Their Avodas Hashem was to be shepherds. They were going to bring every ounce of Kedusha you could possibly bring out of being a shepherd into this world. Rav Dessler seems to be going with the notion that there's a lot of gezel when it comes to making money. And here the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven saw in Avra Yardin the perfect opportunity to raise flocks without having any concern for gezel, and that's how they were going to be Makadesh, the business of shepherding, right? This was a big problem, as we saw between Avram's servants and Lot's servants, that they were fighting over property, whose shepsela were nibbling whose property. Okay, so that's Rav Dessler's answer, that they actually had tremendous bitachon, so much bitachon, as a matter of fact, that they saw that it was tremendous siyata dishmaya, that God gave them the land, just like we saw in the Medrash. God made this whole thing work out. The Midianites fell, but the God and the Reuben were lifted up. They received all this property. They received, right, they had an opportunity. Everything lined up. The stars were all aligned. Everything made sense. It was coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe Rabbeinu, this is our Avodas Hashem. This is where we're meant to be. And this is why Moshe Rabbeinu has no criticism for them. Doesn't need to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because it all works out in Jewish Hashkafos. There's no Chidushim here. Everything is wonderful. Now, Rav Dessler is going to have to answer up to Chazal. Right? We saw a few Chazals over here that said, no, what the B'nai Reuven, the B'nai Gad did was not okay. So Rav Dessler says, of course, we have to realize, if you want to see this Rav Dessler inside, it's towards the end of Chelek Beis, where he goes through the different Parshios, page 254. Okay, Parshios Matos, page 254. So Rav Dessler says that, of course, these were great tzaddikim. Great tzaddikim are judged to the hair's breadth. Okay, say that one five times fast with a mouth full of marbles. But be careful, they could be a choking hazard. The tzaddikim are judged down to the hair's breadth. So the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven are being judged on a much higher level than what? That we see from the fact that they put the flocks before the children, that they had some sort of a negias over here. They were nogea bedavar. They were excited by a little bit more than the Kiddush Hashem that was going to come out of everything that they were doing. There was actually an element of the olam hazeh of it, of the physical part of it, of the wealth of it, that they were excited by. And because they were nogea, they were connected, they had some interest in the worldly aspects of it all. This is why ultimately they were the shoresh of what they were doing. The root of it was not perfect, and it was going to lead to certain kilkulin, to certain mistakes down the line. So what we see over here is the concept of making the ikr tuffel and the tuffel ikr is that the ikr over here obviously is the Avodas Hashem, right? It's making a Kiddush Hashem. That's the ikr. The tuffel is how you're going to make that Kiddush Hashem. It doesn't really matter how you make Kiddush Hashem. Whatever it is, that's secondary to the fact that you're making a Kiddush Hashem. So in this case, the tuffel would have been the sheep. So here, they ended up making the sheep the ikr, right? The sheep were what they placed first. So it showed that maybe they were nogea, they cared a little bit too much about the financial aspect and not as much about the Kiddush Hashem answered as they should have. Now, obviously, Rav Dasha says this is a very minute defect on their level, but it was enough to create a tremendous kilkul in the generations to come. Now, I want to take a different approach than Rav Dessler over here. It's a beautiful Rav Dessler. It really is. And I think it answers a very disturbing question, is to try to understand how the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven could do this. The reason I want to take a different Mahalach is not because there's a specific chisaron in Rav Dessler's Mahalach, but because I think it would be more pashut to stick with the straightforward criticism of the Midrashim. Meaning, with Rav Dessler's, we're a little bit in a dohak, pushing to try to fit the criticism into the Mahalach. So, there's an idea that we see in a lot of places where Moshe Rabbeinu will not criticize the Jewish people or even say anything to the Jewish people at a time when possibly he should. And the precedent for that, of course, is with the previous generation in the case of the Meraglim. When the Meraglim come to Moshe Rabbeinu, he does not at any point tell them that this is going to be a bad idea, although clearly, right, seemingly everybody agrees that this is not a great idea. Kosh Baruch Hu won't even give Moshe Rabbeinu the tzivui to send them out. He says, Shlach Lecha, you do what you want. I'm not getting involved. As a matter of fact, when we go into the Mishnah Torah, when Moshe retells us, we have a Rashi over there who brings a mashal of a person who sells a donkey. And the person says, I want to take your donkey for a test ride. And the man says, no problem. He says, I want to take him up into the highest mountains. I want to take him down to the lowest valleys. He's asking for every possible use of this donkey, right, to get the most out of the donkey in the test ride. And the guy says, no problem. At the end, the man says, okay, no worry. I'll take the donkey. I don't need to ride it. I see you're confident. Right? Rashi is giving a whole mahalach in Moshe Rabbeinu's response to the Jewish people, right? Which is, Moshe Rabbeinu is, in effect, saying, look, you see, I'm so confident, I'm hoping you'll back down and not want to send the spies. So there's a sort of a hidden response in Moshe's response. Now, why can't Moshe Rabbeinu just say to the Jewish people, don't do it, it's a bad idea? Right? Why can't Moshe Rabbeinu actually just tell them, he doesn't have to couch in any sort of interesting mashalim, and Rashi's bringing the mashal, but he doesn't have to try to allude to them anyway. He could just say straightforward to the Jewish people, look, I'm Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm telling you, this is not a good idea. It's not a good idea. Don't do it. So what we see is that at the end of the day, Moshe Rabbeinu cannot be the Jewish people. He can't. He's on a different level than the Jewish people, which is why he's Moshe Rabbeinu, right? He's helping to guide us and shape us. But ultimately, we have to go into Eretz Yisrael on our own volition, under our own choices. So what do we have here? With the case of the Meraglim, basically, there's no Isser to send the Meraglim. The whole concept of sending Meraglim is in and of itself a fine notion, as we see, right? At the end of Maaseh, that we send Meraglim. Right? We see in Sefer Yoshua that Yoshua sends Meraglim. Sending out Meraglim is general hishtadlus when you go into a battle to create a strategic plan. So the fact that the Jewish people wanted to send Meraglim, as far as basic hishtadlus is concerned, is not a problem. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu was nervous that they were nogeya in the whole idea of sending Meraglim, which is why he wanted to discourage it. But we do see, and the Mefarshim speak about it, that it could have been possible for the Jewish people to enter Eretz Yisrael without Meraglim whatsoever. That means a total blind faith in a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that wherever we go, a Kodesh Baruch Hu will lead us. We don't even need to do basic hishtadlus. So you have the B'nai Yisrael coming to Moshe Rabbeinu on a level of regular Emunah and a regular Hishtadlus, to which Moshe Rabbeinu can't say no. He can try to encourage them to be greater than that. But you can't go to a person and say, I want you to be on a higher level of bitachon. I want you to take a higher level of ishtadlus, because if it's not coming from you, then it's not there, and it's not real, and the ishtadlus doesn't exist. Now, we have these sort of cases. We see them by the gedoli, by our gedoli, and the many stories they tell of the Brisker Rav, Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, where they went out into dangerous situations where normal hishtadlus would have said that a person should not go out, right, during war times. But they went out because they were going on a higher level of hishtadlus, or on a higher level of bitachon, where they felt that they were totally davek to Kodesh Baruch Hu, and nothing could actually happen to them. You cannot, however, tell a person to go do that, because if it's not real and it's not them, then it's not going to help. So here, when it comes to the reason why it's these things are so nogeya to us, is because I think it's something we see about Aliyah all the time, right? At the end of the day, this parsha is a parsha about Aliyah, about making Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, right? This is the first group of Olin, right? And this was before they even had Nefesh B'Nefesh benefits. Yeah, so they actually didn't have cars back then. So this is the first group of Olim coming to make Aliyah into Eretz Yisrael. Now, when you see nowadays that there are people who want to come, they want to make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, this is something I think Rabbi Gershenfeld speaks about a lot of times. For most people, Aliyah is not the right thing to do, because Al Pi Hishtadlut, it's very hard to survive, even nowadays, in Eretz Yisrael. So much more so when Rabbi Gershenfeld, in one of the recent shiurim, brought an example of from one of the Igros of Rabbi Yisrael Salant in Or Yisrael, that when you cannot survive, have your basic needs met, it shakes up people's bitachon in a very powerful way, to the point that it may be better for a person to go settle in Chutz La'aretz rather than come into Eretz Yisrael. Someone was actually telling me a story about their Rav, where they live, so that anybody who comes to their Rav and says, should we move to Eretz Yisrael, their Rav always says no. However, if someone says, we're moving to Eretz Yisrael, how should we do it, the Rav always helps them figure out the right way to come to Eretz Yisrael. So I think that we see a pattern, right? We see this also, there was also letters from Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. Now, so we're talking about the early 1900s. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld is trying to encourage Jews in Europe to come and make Aliyah. Now, if you don't know what was going on in Eretz Yisrael at the time, I believe that he did send this before World War I, because things were really impossible during World War I. But Jews were finally, Ashkenazi Jews were finally starting to get a little bit of a foothold in Eretz Yisrael, build a little bit of property, own a little bit of property, which was very big, because this was, you know, under the Turkish Ottomans, these were things which they were not able to do previous. So finally, things were becoming a little bit more livable, a bit more practical. They were trying to encourage Jews in Europe to make Aliyah. One of the questions that Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was asked was that, how are people meant to survive? There's such little limited infrastructure. So the answer, a brilliant answer, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld says that when you go to stay at someone's house, right, when you're talking about friends or coming to stay at your house, you know, it's an important question you have to know. Is there going to be room for everybody? Is there going to be enough food? How are we going to survive? Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld says, however, when you're coming home to your mother, right, when you're going to be by your parents, there's always room for everybody. When you come to Eretz Yisrael, don't worry. Eretz Yisrael will figure it out. Kodesh Baruch Hu will figure it out. We'll figure it out. We'll make space for everybody. We'll find food for everybody. Now, obviously, when he said that, not everybody came running to Eretz Yisrael, because that answer is in itself an answer which is above a regular standard level of ishtadlus. So the approach that I wanted to take over here in the Parsha is that the B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuben cannot be criticized by Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu cannot tell them to go into Eretz Yisrael on a higher level of bitachon than where they're willing to hold at. Meaning they're absolutely 100% right. We're going to borrow some of Rav Dessler's idea over here. The fact that the world, that things played out, the way that they fell out, that everything was going to come to them, the flocks were going to come to them, right, the way that they did. The decision to settle in Eivor HaYarden because that matched the circumstances, that is a correct hishtadlus to go settle in Chutz La'aretz for Parnasa. It's mutter, it's a correct hishtadlus. However, coming into Eretz Yisrael, they could have chosen to be on a higher level of bitachon, living in Eretz Yisrael, and somehow Eretz Yisrael would have to figure out how to sustain the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven in their situation. Okay, this is a different approach, and here it seems to fit, just to go with the Midrashim, in that, right, the fact that the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven chose to be on a lower level of bitachon as opposed to coming into the land where they would have been together with the Jewish people. So Kosh Baruch Hu says that simply when the gullah starts, because you, right, made the decision to be in Chutz La'aretz as opposed to relying on Eretz Yisrael and allowing it to bring you up to the higher level of bitachon, you're going to have to go first. Now, the answer of Chatfu La'atzmam, right, the fact that the Medrash is referring to them as those who grabbed it for themselves. As a matter of fact, let's hold it for a second, because let's talk about the Chatzi Shevet Menashe for a second over here. Half a tribe of Menashe, where did they come from? Right? How did they all of a sudden show up? So there's a famous Ramban over here, but we're not going to go with this Ramban, because we actually have a piece of Chazal. When we have Chazal, right, we're going to stick with Chazal. So, if you want to see this, you can look in the Ayamek Dover, over actually in Dvarim, right? In the beginning of Parshas Dvarim, and Perek Gimel, Pasuk Tet Zayin, he gives a whole Mahalach over here. And he's trying to understand where B'nai Menashe fell into it. Over there, the order of the Psukim is also very difficult. And also the fact that they seem to be getting tons and tons of cities for a half of a little Shevet, right? As lovely a Shevet as they are. But compared to Reuven and Gad, they seem to be getting a tremendous amount of land. So the Netziv is building off of a Yerushalmi. Now it's a Yerushalmi in Bikurim, it's a Brisa over there. It's a very, it's a wonderful Brisa. The Brisa says that you don't bring Bikurim from Eivor HaYarden. Why not? Because the verse says, Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, right? V'lo Eivor HaYarden. Because Bikurim refers to fruits that came from Eretz Yisrael. And Eivor HaYarden, while it has some, wonderful timeshares and great produce, but it's not Eretz Yisrael as far as the produce goes. Okay. Tani asher netata li Hashem. There's a different opinion. Because in what a person says when they bring the Bikurim, they say, this is what Hashem has given me. Ve'lo shenatalti li la'atzmi, and not what I have grabbed for myself. My benayhon, what's between the two opinions? What's between the opinion of the first Tanya that says it's because the fruits are not the fruits of the land of milk and honey, and the second Tanya who says that because part and parcel of bringing Bikurim is that it has to be things that Hashem gave to you, and not things that you grabbed for yourself. Amar Rabbi Avin, Chatzi Shevet Menashe benayhon. Half the tribe of Menashe is between the opinions of the two Tanoim. That is to say, that according to the opinion that the fruits are not from Eretz Yisrael, nobody can bring Bikurim. However, if it's about grabbing for yourself, there, half the tribe of Menashe did not take for themselves. So if they didn't take for themselves, what happened? So the Netziv wants to understand that Moshe Rabbeinu came to the tribe of Menashe, that they didn't take for themselves, but rather Moshe came and he requested that they went to go live in Eivor HaYarden. Now the question is, why Menashe more than anybody else to go live in Eivor HaYarden? Now there's three possibilities that why Menashe is different than anybody else. Right? And why Moshe Rabbeinu has to request this. By the way, what's fascinating about this is the Netziv understands that the reason that half the tribe of Menashe have so much property is because they did not agree with Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu had to keep sweetening the deal and sweetening the deal until they would finally agree to go live in Eivor HaYarden, which, by the way, raises a big question. If they, too, are only willing to go once they have enough property, are they, in fact, any better than Reuven and Gad. They seem to also have a tremendous amount of desire for money. If Moshe Rabbeinu says go, don't you go? Why would you negotiate for better terms? You just go and move to Eivre Yarden. But Moshe Rabbeinu needs to sweeten the deal, and somehow that's okay. We don't seem to have any problem with that. We're not, the half a tribe of Nash is not criticized anywhere for desiring more land than Eivre Yarden. Okay. So the three possibilities of why Menashe may be different. May be the tribe that Moshe Rabbeinu needs on the far side of the Yarden. So one possibility is the fact of who's Menashe, right? Menashe was Yosef's Turgamon. He was Yosef's Melitz. He was the person who was involved in the political aspects of Chutz La'aretz. Now, of course, he's also Yosef's son, which means that they have a tremendous cheshek and appreciation for the land of Israel. As you see, that Yosef's only dying wish is that his bones, right, Atzmos Yosef, make it back to Eretz Yisrael. So it could be that Menashe has the koach of being able to live in Chutz La'aretz, right, Eivre HaYarden, which is not standard Chutz La'aretz, I understand, and still have the cheshek, the desire to connect back to Eretz Yisrael. Now, of course, why half a tribe? I don't know who says it. I've heard a lot of people mention it. I didn't see it inside anywhere, that half a tribe, because if you have a half a tribe on one side and half a tribe on the other side, it will help to keep the connection between Eretz Yisrael and Eivre HaYarden. That's one possibility. Now, the second possibility is that we're going to see at the end of Parshas Maaseh that the Bnei Menashe are the ones who come to Moshe Rabbeinu to work out the whole deal with the Bnei Slavcha to keep things in the tribe, right? We don't want to lose, right, a piece of Eretz Yisrael which was intended for Menashe, right? They have such a deep love and care for Eretz Yisrael that they come to Moshe Rabbeinu to work out a deal to keep things in the tribe, as it were. Okay, so that's another possibility. We see that there is that cheshek, that love of that Menashe has for the land of Eretz Yisrael, maybe more so than the other Shvatim. That's the reason Moshe Rabbeinu sends him over. The third reason is the Netziv's approach, right? The Netziv brings from Gemara's and Sanhedrin that many of the offspring of Mechir and Ya'ir were actually Talmidei Chachamim. And therefore, what Moshe Rabbeinu saw, and this for this the Netziv is quoting a Avos D'Rav Nosson, that the Torah was weak in Eivre HaYarden, and therefore he wanted to send Torah scholars to Eivre HaYarden in order to strengthen the Torah over there. Now, we have another fascinating insight into nowadays living in Eretz Yisrael, staying in Eretz Yisrael, is that we actually have a precedent here set by Moshe Rabbeinu himself that if a Talmud, if there's a community of Jews is weak, that Talmidei Chachamim can actually be asked by the Rebbe, told by the Rebbe, encouraged by the Rebbe, to go to Chutz La'aretz to strengthen that community. And that's something that we do see happen a lot, that Talmidei Chachamim from here go to different communities in Chutz La'aretz in order to strengthen those communities. Okay, so that's the three possibilities why Menashe. Now, of course, the last one, which the Netziv doesn't deal with, is that why Menashe, why not Yisachar, right? And it could be that the first two reasons we gave are painting this third reason, that it's not only that Menashe were Talmidei Chachamim, but they were Talmidei Chachamim with an ability to grapple with life in Chutz La'aretz, or they had a tremendous cheshek for Eretz Yisrael, or all three of those wonderful reasons all bundled up together in half a tribe called Menashe. Okay, now what that doesn't answer is why for Menashe it's not a problem to go live in Chutz La'aretz, and not only that, why it's not a problem for them to ask for good compensation to go live in Chutz La'aretz, right? If the whole problem that we spoke about with the Bnei Reuven, the Bnei Gad, was that they were chatfu la'atzmam, or natlu la'atzmam, right? The two languages of the Medrash and the Yerushalmi. They grabbed for themselves, they took for themselves. So why is Menashe different, and then they're bargaining and moving things around for extra shtiklach of land? Okay, so now we're going to come to answer our question. Wu-Tang versus P. Diddy. What was different about the B'nai Menashe? Why was it okay for them?
Okay.
So we're going to jump over to Parshas Maaseh over here. I say you got to have a little bit of love for the B'nai Eretz Yisrael. Talk about Parshas Maaseh over here. In Parshas Maaseh, in the punkt in the middle of the Parsha, we have the moment where Moshe Rabbeinu starts to assign the Ari Miklat, right? Three in Eretz Yisrael, three in Eivre Yarden. However, the Ari Miklat are actually not effective yet. And they're not going to be effective until Eretz Yisrael is settled many, many years after Moshe Rabbeinu has already died. So Moshe Rabbeinu is involving himself in this mitzvah, even though he won't see it come to its fruition. Okay. There's a pasuk in Kohelet, there's a verse in Kohelet. It's towards, I think, the back third. Ohev kesef lo yisba kesef. A person who loves money will never be satisfied with money. And what's fascinating is that Chazal say on that pasuk, and actually Rashi brings this notion somewhere else, is that ohev mitzvos lo yisba mitzvos. A person who loves mitzvos will never be satisfied with mitzvos. Okay. Now when it comes to money, right, the fact that Shlomo Melech is talking about that someone who loves money will never be satisfied with money, we're going to have to understand why money, why not anything else? Why can't Shlomo Melech be talking about a lot of things maybe that people can't be satisfied? You know, ohev, I don't know, if a person loves tater tots, maybe he can never be satisfied with tater tots. I don't know, but it's specifically, Shlomo Melech is talking about money. There's something about the love of money that you're never satisfied with money. And then, of course, why is that a parallel to mitzvahs? I mean, is it just happens to be that we're talking about mitzvahs? Could we mention anything? Why is it the Chazal learn from ohev kesef lo yisba kesef to ohev mitzvahs lo yisba mitzvahs? So I spent some time thinking about this. And I came up with the fact that money is actually very unique in one aspect. There is nothing else in the world that you can continue to accumulate consistently and really without limit. That is to say, if a person loves chachma, he wants to be the smartest man in the world. It doesn't matter. He could sit from today to the end of his life and he could read the Encyclopedia Britannica from beginning to end, or whatever way he chooses to grow in chachma, and he will never become Einstein. As a matter of fact, he may never learn the whole thing. He might not become even much smarter than he is. Why? Because from the moment he was born, he has a genetic predisposition to the amount of chachma that he could gain. You can have a child who wants to become the greatest Talmud Chacham of the generation, but he probably won't exceed the level of the Vilna Gaon when he was 11 years old. You know, that goes for a lot of us. Right? Certainly for me. Okay, what about physical prowess? A person could love strength. He could want to compete in the Olympics. However, this definitely goes for me. I could, whatever sport, I don't know, curling, doesn't matter. I don't know that I have a shot at any of them for the rest of my life. And I will never be a competitive Olympic level athlete because what I can accomplish in Olympics, in sports, is already predefined from the moment I'm born. There is only one thing in this world which is not predefined from the moment you're born, and that's the amount of money you make. As long as you're living and breathing and moving, you can accumulate more and more and more money. So a person who loves money will never be satisfied with money. That's to say, if you love money itself, you can keep accumulating and accumulating and accumulating it, and it will never end. You could keep desiring more. Now in Ruchnius, this is true by mitzvahs. As long as you're living and breathing and moving, you could keep accumulating mitzvahs without end. There are a lot of things in Ruchnius, right? Examples that we brought with Torah learning. There's a capacity to how much Torah you could learn with your midos. There's a capacity to how much you can improve your midos. However, with mitzvahs, there is no capacity. As long as you're moving and breathing, you can be doing mitzvahs, you could be learning Torah, you could be doing chesed, you could be smiling at people, you could be helping your son brush his teeth properly, one of my favorite mitzvahs. Okay. So that's definitely a parallel the two of them have between them. Let's take the bigger picture. This concept, by the way, is beautifully brought down in the Sefer Minchas Ani, Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger's Sefer on Parshios, really a breathtaking Sefer if you have an opportunity. Okay, so he says that there are two types of people who love money. There's the, it's all about the Benjamin's people. No, those aren't his words. He doesn't actually say that. It's all about the Benjamin's people that just love money for the sake of money, right? Scrooge McDuck. Stick it in the vault, pile it up. The accumulation of wealth is what excites them. It's what drives them. It's what makes them feel alive. And then there's the cash rules everything around me people. People who don't love the money, they don't care about the money. They care about what money gets them. Social influence, respect, honor, a certain type of a lifestyle. That type of a person could be Yisba Kesef. If you love money itself, so money itself has no end to it. You could keep growing and growing money, you'll never be satisfied because you could just get more. However, if you love the influence that money can bring you, that you can be satisfied. There's a certain amount of money that brings you a certain level of influence, right? That you could feel good with what you have and you don't really care how much money is in the bank. So the two examples of Ohev Mitzvos, Lo Yisba Mitzvos are Moshe Rabbeinu and David HaMelech. And then itself, right, well, there were a lot of people who loved Mitzvos. Why are these the two examples? So Rabbi Yaakov Elinter says, because Moshe Rabbeinu, as we see in this week's Parsha, cannot actually get the schar of the mitzvah of the Ari Miklat, right? He can't actually establish them. He can point them out. He could talk about them. He could be on the planning committee, but he won't have the mitzvah of creating the Ari Miklat. David HaMelech is the same thing. David HaMelech cannot build the Beis HaMikdash, right? And yet, he's very involved in just about everything in the Beis HaMikdash other than building it. Who gets the credit in the end of the day? Shlomo, right? This is the house that Shlomo built, not the house that David built. However, because David HaMelech loves mitzvah, he doesn't care about the end result. Now, it's fascinating what works out as a sort of a opposite over here, which means who is satisfied by mitzvahs? It's a good mussar for us. Who is the person who's satisfied by mitzvahs? The person who's doing the mitzvahs for the schar, for the reward, he's doing the mitzvah because of what it's going to get him, he will be satisfied with mitzvahs. That's that like typical Baal Tshuva question that I think we all struggled with at some point. I don't know, maybe also FFB struggled with it. Probably everybody struggles with it. I guess I've never been in FFB, which is really frustrating. After all these years, I still haven't made it. And that's why I'm talking this way. But anyways, that a person will say, the truth is the Mesillas Yesharim addresses it, so it must have been that there were even, you know, Talmid Chachamim who think this way. Look, I believe I've made it into Olam Haba. I believe that my Schuyos are greater than my Chovos. I believe that I have more mitzvahs than Averos. So if I'm in Gan Eden and I'm going to be in perfection, I'm going to be with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, why do I need to, you know, keep pushing and keep exerting and keep, you know, being medactic and pushing more and trying to grow and trying to be greater, right? There's a sort of attitude, a sort of approach that isn't it enough? Can I just stop? So that's the typical, right, person who doesn't love the mitzvahs. He loves the totzah, he loves the schar of the mitzvah. But an ohev mitzvah is a person who loves mitzvahs, a person who does the mitzvah, not because he wants the result, but because he wants to do Ratzon Hashem. He wants to do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from him. So he'll never be satisfied with mitzvahs because even if you can't get the schar, but it's still Ratzon Hashem. It's still what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, so you're still going to do it. Now that is to say, meaning to connect it back to our parsha, that there's a tremendous difference, even in relation to money, what you're going to use the money for. Now to go back, the language of the Medrash over here says that if a person, when is a person zoche to these things? When a person zoche to wisdom, zoche to to wealth, to strength, when they're given from Hashem and they're for the Torah, for the sake of the Torah. Now, you have this again, just to bring you, the Medrash doesn't bring it, but it's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, and Daf Yud Tes, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Davar Zeh Ketuv B'Torah, V'Shanui B'Nevim, U'Mushulash B'Ksuvim, Kol Osek B'Torah Nechasev Matzlichin Lo. Anyone who toils in Torah, his Nechasim, his properties, is successful for him. Right? And he brings a few different psukim. Let's just go to the last one, which is the strongest one, which is where it's written in Nevi'im, where it's written in Tehillim, over here in Ksubim. Ki im b'toras Hashem cheftzo, if a person desires in the Torah of Hashem, u'torasu yaga yomam v'layla, and day and night he toils in his Torah, v'haya ke'etz shatul al palgei mayim, he'll be like a tree who is rooted on deep waters, asher pirio yiten be'ito, right, that his fruits will come out in his time. V'kol mash asher yase yatzliach, everything he does, he will succeed. Okay, so what means to say is not that anybody who sits and learns Torah will become wealthy, because if so, I have a few avreichim for you to meet, just to prove the case. But what it does mean is, will that wealth be a siman bracha for that person? Will it be a hatzlacha for him? Will he be matzliach through his wealth? So when a person uses his wealth, l'shem shemaim, that's when his wealth is his. That's when it's matzliach. That's when it's a bracha for him. The problem, as we recall, with the Bnei Reuven, the Bnei Gad, is they were chotef, or notel, la'atzman. The money wasn't necessarily going for the right intention, for the right matara, the right end goal. Right? If it was at any point money for money's sake, then that money doesn't have a bracha, and therefore it's not a contradiction between the two midrashim. The second medrash says that Kosh Baruch Hu set it up for the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven to have the money. And had they used the money properly, then it would have been called that a Kosh Baruch Hu gave it for them. But the fact that they had the wrong intention in mind, we can no longer say that Kosh Baruch Hu gave it to them. It's called that they grabbed it for themselves, although Kosh Baruch Hu set up the situation for them. Now the Meforshim, some of the Meforshim of Dessler, understands that the Netziv understands that had they waited for the chalukah of the arts, if they would have waited for the actual lots to be drawn, land to be split up as it was meant to, the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven would have had a portion in this land regardless. The fact is that they didn't wait. They came to Moshe Rabbeinu, showed this negias that they had, showed this that they were tainted with this desire for physicality, however minute or abstract it was, whatever it was, but it was there. The fact that they came to Moshe Rabbeinu instead of waiting for Kosh Baruch Hu to come to them. So again, I think also that with the shtadlus, you have this sort of idea of parallel levels of shtadlus, that sometimes a person sees a situation, he goes for it, and then there's a higher level of shtadlus, meaning to say a higher level of bitachon, which is not meant for everybody, where a person allows a Kosh Baruch Hu to bring it to him. Now, of course, there's going to be levels in that also. We don't have to go into the story of the guy on the roof waiting for the helicopter and the whole thing. Okay, everybody knows that story already. Okay, so just to wrap up, we've answered a lot of our questions. We've answered why Moshe Rabbeinu's rebuke is missing, why it's okay for the Bnei Reuven and Bnei Gad to even have this notion of setting in Chutz La'aretz, where Chatzi Shevet Menashe came from, why Menashe, not anybody else, the dispute between Wu-Tang and P. Diddy, right, that the Derech HaTorah is the Derech of cash rules everything around me, and not it's all about the Benjamins, unless we're talking about mitzvahs, in which case it's all about the Benjamins and not cash rules everything around me. Okay, now the final thing I want to do is just to tell a beautiful story about Iker and Tuffel. which, by the way, is just right. We see in the language of Rashi, when Rashi is talking about Iker, making the Iker and the Tuffel, everybody understood what was the Iker and what was the Tuffel. Everybody understood that Olam Haba, Torah, Ratzon Hashem, whatever it is, that is the Iker. You know, raising your children to be B'nai Torah, taking care of your Yiddishkeit, that's the Iker. And the Parnasa is the Tafel. The Parnasa is what you use to strengthen your Avodas Hashem, and not the other way around. Now, this Parsha for me, this is just the mushy, heartfelt part over here. It just, always very powerful to me. Because, you know, it's something that you see over and over and over again. And it gets a little bit frustrating, but it's a reality that's especially one that's grown. I don't know, maybe it was always the reality. Maybe it's something that's more recent. Of parents who, you know, take difficult jobs, have long working hours, live in very difficult places in order to make good parnasa. And if you would ask them why they do it, right, they would say, I'm doing it for my family. I'm doing it for my wife. I'm doing it for my kids. I want my kids to have all the opportunities they've never had. I want them to be in the best schools. I want them to have the nicest clothes, and etc. Now, I believe that that's 100% true. I believe that's exactly why they're doing it. However, go to those children 40 years later and ask them, if you would have had the choice, what would you have preferred? Going to good school, having nice shoes, good clothes, whatever it is, or having your father home more? Okay, maybe your shoes would have been hand-me-down. Maybe you wouldn't have been at the best schools. Whatever it is, right? What would you have preferred? Now, obviously, this is a very multi-layered, and we're not trying to give one answer for every person, because people's situations are different. And for some people, depending who they are and where they are, they might have needed certain luxuries in their lives. But the point that I want to bring out is that sometimes, in the pursuit of giving a better life for their children, sometimes parents lose the ikar and focus on the tuffle. It becomes about the parnasa, right? Creating a certain livelihood for the family, as opposed to keeping a close eye on the family and seeing what the family needs. Now, there's a story, a beautiful story, that I heard when, as a matter of fact, Rabbi Gershenfeld tell about our dear friend Yaakov Cohen. Maybe I shouldn't have said his name. Okay, pretend I didn't say his name. Okay, well, I won't say his English name. We'll keep it at that. That when his father was looking for work, and he found the work in Manhattan, right, as everybody then and now still seems to work in Manhattan. However, obviously he wanted the work because he wanted to create a good life for his family. But he was not excited about the notion of raising his family in New York City. Okay? Didn't think it was the right place to raise his family. So he went searching for a community. And he did not stop till he found the right community, which was somewhere in the middle of Connecticut, which meant that he literally had a 3-hour commute to work so that his children could grow up in the community where he thought they would flourish. Now talk about making the ikar and the tuffle tuffle. He was willing to have tremendous mesiras and nefesh in order to have his children be in the place where he thought that they would flourish. Now, just to go back, because I really could have filled this idea in a little bit better, when a person's parnasa is coming to be mechazek Torah, now that could be his own learning, that could be another person's learning, we see that that's the point when the osher, when the money has bracha, and it's called that a Kosh Baruch who's giving it to you, because now you're using it for what a Kosh Baruch brought into the world, which is the ultimate Kiddush Hashem, which is for Torah. Now here's what's going to come out very interesting. I asked the question, how is it the B'nai Menashe could sort of, you know, finagle Moshe Rabbeinu for more money in order to go to Chutz La'aretz? It seems a little bit sleazy. It seems like a little bit, you know, just as bad or worse than what the B'nai Reuven were doing. What's going on? So like this. When a person is faced with a spiritual battle, you can always, right, there's always the ability to succeed, the always the ability to have victory in any spiritual battle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts in front of you. However, the more fronts that a person creates for himself on the battlefield, the less chance a person has of succeeding. Therefore, if a person wants to grow in midos, he has to choose one midah, and most of the Balei Musar say that he should choose a midah that he's already good in. Why? Because if he's working too hard in one area, he's probably going to fail in other areas, or he might even fail in that area in the first place. This happens, by the way, when a person, let's say, you know, when we came and we moved to a new city. You have to know how many challenges and in which areas of your life you can handle. So I'll give an example. You know, when we first moved here, we were living in a small apartment, and we decided that we were going to be really Israeli, and we were going to make it in a, you know, 83 square meter apartment or whatever it was, and we were going to be fine. And if our guests had to sleep on top of us, then, you know, we'd all hunker down in the hallway, and there would be beds wherever, and we'd move things around. And what we realized, it took us a long while to realize it, was that we were not happy there. Now, certainly, we understood that a person could be happy wherever they are. And we could have been happy there. But the amount of other challenges that are happening simultaneously when a person moves to a new city between, you know, new shuls and new places to learn and socializing and the school system and everything is that it was just something we did not have the energy to deal with. And therefore, we moved to a bigger apartment, right? We had to find the means to do that, and we tried to find the way, and we had a lot of Seyata Dishmaya. But we understood that it was not a place where we were going to succeed. So here too, when Chatzis Sheva Menashe is being asked by Moshe Rabbeinu to go to Eivre HaYarden, right? So if a person comes to you and says, look, I need you to go move to Munich, right? The Jewish community there is weak, and we need to go strengthen the Jewish community in Munich. Now, okay, you know that moving to Munich is going to have a tremendous amount of challenges that come along with it. So now this, I'm just imagining myself, this person saying, you're going to Munich, you're going to be whatever, the Rosh Kol in Munich. Hooray, that's so exciting. Okay, what's my salary? Oh, it's the regular salary of an Avreich in Eretz Yisrael. Slicha? It's the regular salary of an Avreich in Eretz Yisrael. Wait, what are we talking about? We're talking about 1,800 shekels, 2,200 shekels, 2,500 shekels? No, we're talking 2,200 shekels. We'll give you the nice average. 2,200 shekels, right? So what are we talking about? $450 a month, $500 a month? To go live in Munich. Now, even if you're a very holy Jew and you have a tremendous aspirations to help your brethren over in Chutz La'aretz, you realize that with all the challenges of living in Chutz La'aretz, if you're also going to have the challenge of finances, right, you're probably going to get crushed. And so therefore, the B'nai Menashe could be turning to Moshe Rabbeinu in all fairness and saying, look, we're happy to move to Eivre HaYarden, but we can't do it if we're going to be living there, right, as the Avreichim, the B'nai Reuven, the B'nai Gad are going to have all their property, and we're going to be the Shnorers, we're going to be Avreichim, we're going to be barely making ends meet. We're not going to be able to succeed. And so Moshe Rabbeinu and them have to work out what they believe would be the appropriate amount in order for them not to have the battle of Gashmius, because other battles, they will have other battles. And this is, again, because everything that's coming for the sake of Torah, as long as they're truly coming for the sake of Torah, it's not for the property himself, that property can actually have bracha, there's actually a chance of success in everything that they're doing. Now, the B'nai Reuven, the B'nai Gad, just to bring it around full circle with the example that we brought of parents, B'nai Gad, B'nai Reuven said, why do we want to raise our sheep over here? It's for our children. Of course it's for our children. They knew that that was the ikur. They didn't think the children were actually tuffled to the sheep. They knew that that was the ikur. However, if you would ask the children, the offspring of the B'nai Reuven, as a matter of fact, you can go look at Sefer Yehoshua if you want to see the moment when it actually happens, and you say to them, would you rather have the money, would you rather have the sheep, would you rather have the lifestyle, or would you rather be trying to figure it out in Eretz Yisrael with the Jewish people, next to the base of Mikdash, with your brethren, Right? I mean, you have to realize someone who lives in Eivre HaYarden, I don't know how many times these types of people, these people ever made it to Aliyah LeRegel. How many times they actually saw the Beis HaMikdash. Right? They're outside of Eretz Yisrael, and at the time, right, it's not like the Jordan River of today, nicely dammed off and dredged for us. This was a raging, roaring river. How many times did these people see the Beis HaMikdash? I don't know. And that's tough, you know, to know that you are from the 12 tribes and you chose a parcel of land outside of Eretz Yisrael. I don't remember if there's a medrash like this in Vayikra, and then there's the occasion in Sefer Yehoshua where they actually build the Mizbech to remind themselves, right, that they have a chelik in Eretz Yisrael. Just to sort of bring back around the idea of making the Ikar and the Ikar Tafel. Okay, so that's it for this week's Parsha, a little bit for Matos, a little bit for Maaseh. I hope it was meaningful, and have a great Shabbos.